Someone just asked me if that clip we saw of James Sparrow's mother is readily available. So it is on YouTube. If you just put a search in for James Sparrow's mother, there it is. Did anybody try the exercise? So I mentioned before I had been looking at this book, recording a meeting between the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. So I want to talk a little bit more about that. Certainly recommend the book. It's very uplifting. From the introduction, lasting happiness cannot be found in pursuit of any goal or achievement. It does not reside in fortune or fame. It resides only in the human mind and heart, and it is here that we hope you will find it. So that's from the introduction to this book. So I just wanted to talk a little more about the book and how it came to be. It took place around the birthday of the Dalai Lama, his 80th birthday. And so he invited Archbishop Desmond Tutu to his home in Dharamsala. And then I guess a little project formed around it, that they were going to spend a week together and talk about joy. And another, an author was going to be with them who knew them already, Douglas Abrams. And so I gather that after the week, he took various transcripts and then assembled them into this book, which is called The Book of Joy, Lasting Happiness in a Changing World. And one thing that I mentioned maybe before, that it was a very lighthearted relationship. They had only met, I think, a half dozen times previously, but had developed a very strong friendship. And kind of a goofy friendship. They're always teasing each other, and the Archbishop is speculating if the Dalai Lama is going to get into heaven, and, you know, they're just always, like, poking each other and teasing. And it's kind of organized. They've got one section that's called the Pillars of Joy. So they've kind of got suggestions for eight different areas that are kind of causal factors for joy to arise. And so those eight are perspective, looking at things from different angles, humility, humor, which we talked a little bit about, acceptance, forgiveness, gratitude, compassion, and generosity. They also talked about some obstacles to joy and kind of the first section, the nature of true joy. Now, they're both, in my estimation or view, very joyous people, but they've both come through some very difficult times and seen all kinds of suffering. And they come from very different traditions and cultures and countries and backgrounds. And in general, they are very much in agreement on the various aspects that they present in the book. I wanted to mention one area that I found kind of curious, that they actually disagreed on. And so I find it interesting when two people that I respect, you know, have different point of view. So just to kind of reflect for myself on that. And the so the area where they disagreed was, it was they were talking about, say, when negative states arise, and then what to do. So they were generally in agreement on that, like if negative states like anger, envy, different kind of problematic states would arise, which is kind of part of our human condition, then how to address that. So they were in agreement on that. Where they kind of disagreed was, it was, can one, through one's practice and intention, discourage those negative qualities to arise? And the Archbishop Tutu says, no, they're just going to come. It's part of the human condition. You know, that's kind of the way it is. And then you can skillfully deal with those as they arrive, as they arise. You know, notice them and then work skillfully. And the Dalai Lama was pretty consistent in saying, you know, and they disagreed, I thought, really skillfully, with so much respect for each other, and yet they still put forth their point of view. And the Dalai Lama said, no, you can diminish these qualities, say negative emotional states from coming up. I don't know if he said that, but it is consistent with Buddhist teachings in that it is said that, like, someone who is fully enlightened has completely eradicated the negative qualities of greed, hatred, and delusion, which we talked a little bit about at the beginning of the day. So there was this kind of disagreement, but very skillful disagreement. And so I tend to lean towards the Dalai Lama's side of things, that these qualities, kind of negative emotions, over time, if one has that intention, and that they can be diminished. It can be less strong that they arise and less frequent. Now, one thing I was reminded of, that doesn't just happen by itself. I don't know, is anyone familiar with the Dalai Lama's practice routine? Do you want to say what?
Well, he gets up at 4 o'clock every morning to practice.
Yeah.
Practice meditation.
Yeah. And actually, you're late on that. It's actually 3.
Is it 3?
Yeah. So the Dalai Lama, he's the leader of the Tibetan peoples, like kind of the political leader, and has all those things going on, and yet he lives in exile and travels around, but he practices from 3 a.m. until 8 a.m. every day. He's 80 years old. So he is saying that these qualities can be diminished, but he's also providing quite an example. One's excuses kind of seem kind of weak, you know, for, I can't meditate today, you know, compared to his example. And I kind of wonder, too, is if one's point of view on that can influence the outcome. If you think that, oh, I don't think these can change, if that actually might be self-fulfilling. And I'm sure we might have had those thoughts ourselves or heard someone else saying, you know, that's just the way I am. I'm an angry person, and, you know, that's that. But, and that, yeah, that's probably going to stay that way. So it could be, you know, I wonder, anyway, if that's also self-fulfilling. I don't know if it has also anything to do with their backgrounds, Christian versus Buddhist. Maybe you gotta, I don't know. I don't want to offend any Christians here. But, you know, obviously they do have come from very, very different backgrounds, but have this, so it's very, I think, inspiring that they have such a deep relationship and inspiring relationship. So I'd like to talk a little bit now about obstacles to joy. So I talked earlier about three qualities. This was in the Kalama Sutta about these qualities of greed and aversion and delusion that create kind of problems in our lives and in other people's lives as kind of harmful to ourselves and others. So that's the Buddha actually talked about those a lot, and he called them the three poisons. Sometimes he called them the three fires. And I'm just going to refer to another related list that the Buddha taught about. You may have heard of the five hindrances, and these are very closely related to these three that I previously mentioned. So we could call these hindrances to our practice, hindrances to awakening, but also hindrances to joy and well-being. And I'd like to refer to the Buddha's teachings, because the Buddha was very rich in his use of metaphor in describing some of these qualities. And for these five qualities that I'll mention, he uses different metaphors around water and the clarity of water. So the I think that if water is still and clean and clear, then you can see right through it. So it's which I think is he's indicating that we can see things as they are, an indication of wisdom. So these five similes. So the first is desire, that's sensual desire, as a hindrance, is like a bowl of water mixed with red, yellow, blue, or crimson dye. So I think these images are like, oh, it's really pretty. We could get caught up in that. And that could obscure seeing clearly. So the simile for ill will, the second hindrance, first hindrance, sensual desire, second hindrance, ill will. We've talked about that quite a bit today. Is a bowl of water heated over a fire, bubbling and boiling. So again, you can't see through. And an apt metaphor for anger, ill will, or hatred. You know, that heat. So the next hindrance is, I might call it sleepiness. Sometimes it's called sloth and torpor. It's that nodding meditation that you sometimes have. Here it's called lethargy. And it's a bowl of water covered over with water plants and algae. and not very clear. I'm sure we've all had meditations like that. The next one is restlessness, another favorite. So it's a bowl of water stirred by the wind, rippling, swirling, churned into wavelets. Again, can't see through. This is not clear. And then the last hindrance. So the first four are, I think, reasonably, I'm not going to say easy, but, you know, we can probably have a chance at detecting, at having awareness as they arise. So the last is much trickier, and it's doubt. Because doubt can be very subtle, can seem kind of clever, but it is a bowl of water that is turbid, unsettled, muddy, and placed in the dark. There's no way you're going to see through that. And that's where you're like, oh man, oh this Vipassana, I don't know about that. Maybe I should try the Tibetans. Or, you know, the Zen, that looks kind of attractive. Or maybe I'll join that other group, that mindfulness group down the street. Or that Sufi dancing, that's pretty good, you know. So it's almost like a water spider that's just dancing on the surface and can't penetrate. And can't really, if we go back to that Kalama Sutta, can't really see, you're not even giving yourself a chance to see if this is skillful or unskillful. So Ajahn Sona from Birken Monastery, I found this an interesting quote. He says, "The hindrances are a misinformation factory." A factory of misinformation, which is kind of congruent with the unclarity of the water. So what's this have to do with, say, joy or happiness? So there's five other similes about how it feels. And these are quite striking, how it feels if one abandons a hindrance or a hindrance is lifted, one no longer experiences that hindrance. So this is called happiness arising from the abandoning of hindrances. And they're given in a certain order, so I'm going to just assume that it's the same order as the usual order of the hindrances. So it doesn't directly say that in the sutta I was reading, but I'm going to assume that. So the first would be around sensual desire or greed, and imagine that lifts and or is abandoned. Suppose that a person is in debt and then able to repay that loan. And actually, in the sutta, it says you've actually taken that money, done something useful with it, and then it repaid it. Because of that, that person would experience gladness and happiness. So you're in debt, and you've finally paid off the mortgage, and you just feel much lighter, not owing anyone anything. So that's around that habitual greed or sensual desire, which is never fulfilled, and that disappears. The next one is around aversion or anger. This seems appropriate. Now, this suppose that a person falls sick, in pain, and seriously ill. And that's what I would say anger actually feels like if we pay attention rather than immediately going to, and that person is to blame for how I feel. That's generally what we do. Or, I can blame inanimate objects, right? But I think that happens so fast because we don't actually want to feel what that feels like. So suppose that a person falls sick, in pain, and seriously ill. They eventually recover from that illness. Because of that, they would experience gladness and happiness. So you were really, really sick, and then you got better, and you experienced that happiness. Sources of happiness. The next one would be around the sleepiness, sloth and torpor. Suppose a person is bound and is in prison, but eventually released from that bondage. Because of that, they would experience gladness and happiness. So that seems also appropriate that, you know, when you're just overcome with that sleepiness, that it's almost like you can't get out. It's kind of like you're bound and in prison. Next one is around restlessness. So this is interesting. Now suppose a person is a slave, subject to others, not subject to themselves, unable to go where they like, is eventually freed from that slavery, experiences freedom. Because of that, they would experience gladness and happiness. And then the last is around doubt. Suppose a person is carrying valuables and has to travel by road through a desolate and dangerous country. As time passes, they eventually emerge from that dangerous country safe and sound with no loss of valuable property. Because of that, they would experience gladness and happiness. So that's around doubt, yeah. Now, so then the question is, and I can't go into this very fully, but how to remove hindrances once they have arisen. And I think, for me, the most important step is to notice that they have arisen and identify that, say, emotion as a hindrance. And easier said than done, right? But possible. That's why over and over we develop our awareness, and this is one of the things we develop awareness of. We can have awareness of simple things like breathing and walking, but when we start to have awareness of our mind states, some of those mind states are difficult mind states and can be quite deceptive. But I think it is possible as we develop our awareness to be to notice, oh, that is a hindrance. And that's where mindfulness comes in, that we have kind of set our life on a path where our intention is non-harm. So we remember, oh yeah, I'm interested in pursuing this path of non-harm. And this is not taking me down that path. This is not useful. So with that kind of awareness and mindfulness, that I think that in itself is the key to then, you might then need some other techniques or, but that's the big step to get to that point of identifying that as a hindrance. And for example, when anger arises, it's so fast that it can kind of take you down down a path that we don't want to go. Or in retrospect, then we say, oh, I said something that I regret, or all the things that come along with anger. So we are developing those are habit patterns that are part of the human condition, but we can develop other habit patterns, more healthy and beneficial habit patterns. One instruction is to, if you take each of those hindrances, to then, and you've come to the point that you've identified, oh, that's a hindrance. That's a hindrance. To then consciously focus on the opposite. So if we do have anger, ill will, then we say, oh, I'm going to just see if I can do some metta practice or wishing goodwill for others. That would be an example. And the Buddha talked about that. It's kind of like in carpentry, where you have a two pieces of wood that are joined with a peg. And he said, you know how you might not, there's something defective with that peg in the joint, so you can bang out the peg. And what do? You use another peg to bang out the peg you don't want to get in. So you use a much more skillful peg to put in to replace the other peg with. So some of the opposites would be, say, for desire or greed, we could, if we're notice that and focusing on the opposite, it would be generosity. As I mentioned, anger, it would be goodwill, agitation or restlessness, if we have identified some kind of serenity practices, the breath can help us in that. Sloth and torpor or sleepiness, imagine light, imagine water. There's some other suggestions the Buddha has made, not necessarily on the opposite, but meditation on faith, meditation on death, that can bring energy to our practice. Just the fact, the inevitability of aging, sickness, and death can give rise to energy to combat the sloth and torpor. And then doubt, gain serenity practices to allow one to get a little deeper as opposed to just hovering on the surface. And one other suggestion the Buddha made is asking questions of wise people. So rather than just get caught up in your own, should we do this, should we do that, you could ask a question. So here's a quote from Richard Wagamese. Wagamese. I am not the endless chatter in my head. I am the me who recognizes that chatter is happening. I am not the me who is impatient in the grocery line or at the stoplight. I am the me who recognizes and acknowledges that impatience. If I take a breath and change the chatter to, this is me waiting calmly, this is what the experience becomes. So we create our own experience. Practicing this simple awareness allows me to be present in all moments to fully inhabit my life. So that's a little bit about the five hindrances. It's kind of a classic teaching of the Buddha of the qualities to abandon. A few other qualities that just came to mind was qualities like self-judgment or shame or guilt, that we can fall into. These are obstacles to joy. And I mentioned this before, a quote from the Buddha. The Buddha said that we could search the whole world over and not find anyone more deserving of kindness and care than ourselves. I think perfectionism and can be a hindrance. Well, definitely is a hindrance to joy. So an example of that, I taught Tai Chi for a number of years in Toronto, and I was teach a course regularly at University of Toronto. And there, at the end of the course, there'd be evaluations would get filled out by the students. And so they were anonymous, you know, evaluations, but I would have a look at them. And if there was 29 glowing evaluations and one that had one criticism in it, my mind, it would be very difficult not to just focus on that criticism. And I'm sure we've all had that kind of experience. Now, I think if one is criticized, it's good to pay attention and to take that in and to see if that's, you know, one can do anything about it or respond in any way, but not to forget that there was a lot of positivity coming out of that as well. A feeling of lack, I think, is a hindrance to joy. And James Baraz, who we saw in the video, who was talking about a early in his kind of search, spiritual search, he was in India with a teacher there. I think the teacher's name's Punjaji, and he was talking about this sense with his teacher about this sense of lack, and the teacher kind of responds with kind of energy and kind of that kind of teaching. He says, "You feel this lack all the time? I don't understand it. You are knee deep in grace." So James often tells that story. You are knee-deep in grace. So many things that he's forgetting to appreciate about his life. And one of the reasons in this kind of little altar area, I suggested putting message, you know, thinking of people who are both suffering, but also others who may be joyous or, you know, inspiring people, is that, I mean, that's what life is. We have both sides. There's difficulties and there's joy. So avoiding the painful aspects of life can just shut down the joy in our life as well. Thich Nhat Hanh, I think this was in an interview. "You know, I think the hardest thing for people, especially in the West, is to learn the art of suffering. We can't learn the art of happiness until we're okay with suffering. And that's the price we don't want to get to, that we don't want to pay, to learn the art of suffering." So those are just some thoughts on kind of the what obscures or prevents joy from arising. Now, some of those have their answers right within, like when we were talking about the hindrances and the lifting of the hindrance, joy arises. But I just wanted to talk a little more about the opposite side. What supports joy? What are causal factors for joy to arise? Talked a little bit about some of these. So humor, and there's a chapter devoted to humor in the book with the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu. In that book, the Dalai Lama is speaking to some journalists about their reunion with his friend Desmond Tutu. So I think this is maybe before the Archbishop Tutu has arrived on the plane, and there's some journalists around, and they're asking him. So then I told them that you often used to describe me as a mischievous person. And so I said, you are also a mischievous person. Then I said, the meeting of two mischievous people is wonderful. So, very happy reunion. And another, something else from the book. I think Desmond Tutu was teasing the Dalai Lama about his chances of getting into heaven. So it's pretty funny moment. And so following this teasing, you know, was him saying, so he came right down to this beautiful comment. I think one of the best things that ever happened to me was meeting you. This was Desmond Tutu to the Dalai Lama. We talked about with watching the video, that suggestion, and I am truly blessed. That appreciation is something that joy builds on, arises from. And then ethical conduct. We chanted the five precepts at the beginning of the day, and that's a foundational piece for joy to arise. And so in Pali, this is called sila. So sila is really about non-harm. It is an expression of metta. Our sila protects our own mind, and our sila protects others. It helps us to have a settled mind, both in our lives and in our meditation. One other quality is generosity. We've talked about a little bit, dana. And so this reminds me of a story that a monk who's been here, Ajahn Tiridamo, has told. He's a Westerner. He's a Surrey boy. But he has been a monk in the Thai forest tradition for many years. And he was became the abbot of a, believe it or not, a Thai forest monastery in Switzerland. Now, there's a lot of Thai people, especially Thai women, I guess, who've married Swiss men living in Switzerland. So they would come out, and this is part of the Thai culture. They took great joy in bringing food, gathering food, going shopping, and then coming to the kitchen at the monastery and preparing this food for the meal. And this meal would be for the monks, and if there was a retreat happening, for fellow retreatants. And so Ajahn Tiridamo talks about coming into the monastery and hearing this joyous laughter coming from the kitchen, from the Thai ladies engaged in preparing this food, this act of generosity that was producing so much joy for them. And then going into the meditation hall and seeing mainly Westerners just kind of focused with furrowed brows, not much joy arising from their practice, I think, from that kind of striving. And it's kind of like, so I think that that is something that as Westerners we can incorporate into our practice, that practice of generosity and the joy. You know, it's not that it is creates more problems for us. It is actually a joy arises from that. Then gratitude and appreciation. Well, we've already talked a bit about James Barras and his mother and that kind of changing of perspective produced very beneficial results in a pretty short period of time for her. I mean, she seems like a pretty joyous person anyway, but it seemed quite, as the son and daughter reported, quite a shift. So that can happen for us as well. From the book with the Dalai Lama, this is the author Douglas Abrams speaking or writing, who knows both of them very well. And he writes, "I have never seen Archbishop Tutu miss an opportunity to thank someone or appreciate, what he has been given. He will often stop an entire production or an event to acknowledge all that are present." Well, that's something we could do. We could just kind of just take a moment and appreciate all the people who came to help us on our path and help us appreciate different aspects of joy. And it's much easier to do with other people who are interested and motivated in the same way, walking in the same direction. I've talked a fair bit about metta already. Here is a little story from a monk whose name is Bhante Gunaratna. We refer to him as Bhante G. He's a Sri Lankan monk. This is from, he's written a number of books, and it's kind of like mindfulness in plain English and different things in plain English. This is called Loving Kindness in Plain English, The Practice of Metta. So we might think, oh, metta, you have to be a kind of pretty exalted and, sending metta out to far reaches of the universe. It's pretty exalted kind of a practice. And this is what he writes that he includes in his practice. This is metta practice. "When I travel, sometimes I go to public bathrooms. If the bathroom is not clean, I clean it. On airplanes, I clean the bathroom after I use it. I wish the next person coming to the bathroom will be pleased to see a clean toilet. Nobody knows who cleaned the toilet. I feel very glad to have done it." Small things like this are in truth not small at all. They are ways to practice loving friendliness. He calls it loving friendliness every day. So, we have plenty of opportunities. So then, compassion, if we think of, say, the people who have been placed on the altar, names or groups of people who are suffering. So compassion is a subset of metta. Loving kindness or goodwill when when that meets someone who is suffering. And it is universal. It's not just for those close to us, family or friends. And it's not something that pulls us down. It's not sympathetic grief. So Ajahn Sona calls compassion the sacred recipe. Now, a related quality that we can develop is, so we have metta, or goodwill, compassion. And the next quality that is related in there is called mudita. And we don't actually have, as far as I know, a word for mudita in English. Sometimes it's referred to as sympathetic joy. So it's that when one is feeling metta, expressing these wishes of goodwill, and you meet someone who is experiencing good fortune or joy, then we can feel joy with them. It's kind of like a reverberation. So I've heard that the Dalai Lama was talking about this, and he said that your odds are very good to increase your level of joy. You know, there's 7 billion people in the world. The odds are pretty good someone out there is experiencing joy, and if you can experience joy with them, your odds are very high. So I do think it is interesting that that we don't have a word in English that directly translates for mudita. It's a great cure for envy. But Ajahn Sona has said, normally you would like to be the winner, but you can be the winner every time. And here's a kind of a chant or wishes of this sympathetic joy. This is from an older Sinhalese text. How wonderful you are in your being. So we can practice this. How wonderful you are in your being. I delight you are here. I take joy in your good fortune. May your happiness continue. So these are expressions of generosity, selflessness, and appreciation. And we can offer these wishes to ourselves as well as others. So I'd just like to talk about, there is a teaching that the Buddha gave that's called the six recollections, and this recollections can give rise to joy. So some of these we've just touched on a little bit. So the six recollections are recollecting the Buddha, and we can think about the Buddha's qualities that we can cultivate. The Dhamma, or the teachings of the Buddha, also meaning the truth. And the Sangha, the group of monks and nuns that have kept the teachings alive, or your own community, the people, your spiritual friends. So the Buddha, recollecting the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha are three of the six recollections that can give rise to joy. Recollecting one's virtues, recollecting one's generosity can give rise to joy. We've talked about virtue, sila, and generosity as well. Now, the last recollection is something that is not really talked about too much in the West, so I just thought it's worth kind of investigating a little bit. So the last, and I think it's because it doesn't really fit with our worldview. our cosmology. But the last recollection, which will give rise to joy, is recollecting the devas, cause for joy to arise. And just a quote from the suttas, any time when a disciple of the Noble Ones is recollecting any of these six, the mind is not overcome by greed, aversion, or delusion. The person gains a sense of the Dhamma, of the truth, of these teachings, gains joy connected with the Dhamma. In one who is joyful, rapture arises. In one whose mind is enraptured, the body grows calm. In one whose body is calmed, that person experiences great ease. And this leads to the mind becoming concentrated. Now, that's so that's a sequence that... So these six give rise for joy. I'm just going to quote something from Ajahn Jeff. I'm just kind of curious when there's a teaching and maybe it hasn't been talked about very much, just because maybe it's a different way of viewing the world. So this is from an article from Ajahn Jeff. Recollection of the devas. So devas are different realms, different kind of god realms, different... also the Brahma Viharas are in these realms as well. The Metta, for example, is in these realms. Recollection of the devas is a meditation exercise few people practice, but it's a useful practice for several reasons. It reminds us of the possibilities out there. People sometimes have visions when they meditate, and beings sometimes appear in the visions. If you have an impoverished cosmology, like we have in the West, we may not know how to be with this experience. We might be frightened, or we may think we are somehow... it might lead to being frightened if there's a vision, but it also might lead to our ego being inflated, like, oh man, I had this amazing vision. I'm special. So neither of these are useful in the spiritual journey. The recommendation is just to treat them politely. Say something appears in your... you have a vision. A deva appears. As neighbors that you want to get along with. So visions like this might happen in your meditation. It doesn't happen only in Asia. I know people who, especially here in the Southwest, where he has a monastery, have had lots of visions when they go to places like Bryce, Zion, or Arcs, Spirits of or Arches. And the visions are spirits of Indians, the coyote god, lots of spirits corresponding to Native American legends. Some of these meditators have no knowledge of Native American legends. So it's good to remember the basic principle for how you treat devas. You recollect their virtues. You treat them with respect. And then you take what you learn from them and you put it to the test to see if it is really conducive to training the mind. So that's an interesting kind of reflection. And it may happen in your meditation that you may have a vision and then you have a sense of, how to deal with that. And in a sense, it goes back to the advice to the Kalamas. It's like, well, is this useful? Maybe I'm getting some advice, but I shouldn't just take it at face value. I should put it to the test and see if this is useful or not. And then Ajahn Jeff goes on to list some deva virtues that we can recollect, which can give rise to then happiness. And he lists faith, virtue, discernment, and goodwill. So I'm just going to read one more quote from Richard Wagamese, and then, well, there are three very short quotes. Then we'll take a little break and then get back together for some chanting and just some reflections to kind of wrap up the day. So one way that Richard Wagamese, the author, he uses is he recreates a conversation, and he has this conversation with either old man or old woman. So here's a couple of them. Old man, you know what your problem is, Wagamese? Me, no. Old man, that's what your problem is. I became a better person after that. Old man, you know what your problem is, Wagamese? No. That's what your problem is. So we have to really make sure we know what the problem is. Old woman, you can't fix what's in your head using what's in your head. Me, what do I do then? Old woman, unlearn. Me, how do I do that? Old woman, choose differently. So the wisdom in that is it's not really about beliefs and views and opinions. It's about our actions. Like a choice is an action then. And me, what if we're wrong? Old woman, wrong about what? All this me, all this prayer, ceremony, meditation, what if at the end of it, all there is nothing? Old woman, then we still come out better people. Me, how? Old woman, can you think of a better way to live than in gratitude? Can you think of a better way to be than to be kind, loving, compassionate, respectful, courageous, truthful, and forgiving? Even if we're wrong, can you think of a better way to breathe than through all that? I couldn't.